Good Yom Tov. Chag Sameach and Shana Tova to everyone. I would first want to announce what's happening, what's coming up, so that if anybody ends up leaving shul before we conclude with Rosh Hashanah Tova, that you'll know what is going on. And this afternoon, on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, the minhag, the custom, the tradition, is to take some pieces of that round challah that we eat, not the ones with honey, because then it'll get your pocket all sticky, but to take some of the pieces of challah from the table and to go to a, to go to a body of water, which I had some now actually, to go to a body of water, particularly where fish are swimming, and to cast the crumbs from the table into the water and watch the fish gobble them up. And that becomes symbolic. It's a metaphor for our sins, for our transgressions over the past year. Things that we did that we really shouldn't have done, or things that we neglected to do that we should have done. And it's an expression of our hope that on these high holidays we'll become cleansed from those transgressions, just as those pieces of challah disappear from the surface of the water. It's called tashlich, which means to cast. And it's a beautiful ceremony. In my childhood, it was a highlight, one of the many highlights of Rosh Hashanah. But to go, particularly as teenagers, we would not go where our parents were. We went to where the other teenagers were, in Prospect Park. And there was a long walk, too long for our mother and father. And we go to Prospect Park, and the other teenagers from Flatbush would come, and from Borough Park, and from Bensonhurst, and we came from Crown Heights, and so on, all converged for Tashlich. A wonderful, wonderful, beautiful, beautiful custom. And there are people from all over San Francisco and the Bay Area who gather in different places for Tashlich. If you find it more convenient, go to the lake in Golden Gate Park, or else to Lake Merced, or most of the B'nai Emunah people go all the way to the ocean. It's long after lunch, and wherever you go, cast away those sins and let it transform not just the fish who wait every year, by the way, you know, they wait every year till the Jewish people have Tashlich. And they get very confused, because when the first day of Rosh Hashanah is on a Shabbat, it's the second day, and the fish think on that first day when it's a Shabbat, they wonder, so what happened? Did the Jews leave San Francisco? Then they hang around, they get it the second day, but today it's the first day. Oh, thank you, Howard. And you'll see that if you do that, your prayers can be answered like mine was. Perfect. Jerry, thanks for getting the water cooler fixed. That's where it comes from. It's good. Our phenomenal chauffeur blower, David Volansky, and I, and also filling in Owen Liebman, whose wife is one of the co-owners of Dayenu, the religious bookstore and religious object store next to the JCC, will have to squeeze Tashlich in at some point, because we're going to spend the afternoon going to the homes of people who could not make it to shul this year because of illness. In most cases, we're not able to go. And we started a custom 2 years ago, this will be our third year, to go from home to home, members of my congregation, anybody else has requested, and sound the shofar for them. And I mention this to you because if you know someone who could use that kind of a visit, if they're not here, I don't get to know in advance everybody who didn't make it to shul. So if you know somebody, please let me know, let David know, and we'll still see to it that we make it to their home, wherever it is. I mean, on this side of the Mississippi. We'll make it to their home and blow shofar for them. And I want to talk about the shofar this morning. I want to explain why the sets of the shofar blasts are the way they are. Did you ever wonder? We started with tekiya, and then we go to Shvarim Teruah, and then Tekiya again. We do that three times. The long blast, and then the broken blast of three, and then the staccato of nine. We do that three times. And then we do the long blast again, the tekiah, and just the shvarim, just the three blasts. And the tekiah again. We do that three times. And then the tekiah, the long blast, and this time only the teruah, the nine little blasts. And we do that three times. You know, we're not a religion of mystery. There's a reason for everything. And I want to share with you the basis of that seder, that order of the shofar blasts. It comes from a debate in the Talmud amongst the sages who gave different interpretations of the sound of the shofar. Now, we know that in temple times, the sound of the shofar was a symbol of rejoicing, of announcing important events, of a call to military battle, of the Yovel, the Jubilee, even Rosh Chodesh, and other times the shofar would be sounded. It was to call the people's attention to an important event happening. But in the Talmudic period, where life was far from good, where the temple existed, but the priests were appointed by the Romans, Jewish people did not have their own sovereignty, where life was harsh and difficult, where Roman governors took what they wanted and the soldiers went and took the rest, where people's lives were held on by a string, where there was rape, there was murder, there was stealing and pillaging all the time. The sages of the Talmud saw a different meaning in the sound of the shofar. In the tractate of Rosh Hashanah, the Talmud demonstrates this variation of opinion by saying that the sound of the shofar is to replicate the sound of the human being sighing. Oh. 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 The attempt to get out the sense of pain that the individual feels inside. And the opposing argument was, no, the shofar goes even further than that. It is the staccato sounds of weeping, of crying. Ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta is the cry. The sound of pain deep inside, so much so that it becomes uncontrollable. In other words, the sound of the shofar is to evoke the expression of what we feel inside when we are in touch with our emotion of pain. To sigh, to cry. I want to ask you, if you will, take a moment and think of the last time you cried. You can close your eyes if you need to. Think. When did I really have a good cry? Some people can remember it very vividly. Others can't remember it at all. And that's actually the story of the people whom we read about in the Torah today and in the Haftarah. There are some who are able to cry and some who couldn't. Hagar cried. That concubine of Abraham who had bore him a son, Ishmael. And then when Sarah gets pregnant and she has her own Yitzchak, she convinces Abraham to cast her away. And he sends her into the wilderness with some water. And there she is with a little boy and she sees there's no more water. He's dying of thirst and she can't bear. She can't bear to see him suffer like that. And the Torah says that Hagar cried. She cried deep from within her heart that only a mother could cry when she sees a child suffering. destined for death. The Torah says, a Malach comes down from on high and says, Hagar, you don't need to cry. There is water in front of you. And she reaches for the water and she gives it to her son, and they live. Tomorrow we're going to read about Avram being called upon in this dream and this vision to sacrifice his son. That son that his wife Sarah has been waiting for all of those decades. The son of his old age. The one through whom he was promised his progeny would ultimately be like the stars in the heavens above and the sand in the sea. And there he stands with a knife above his son who was bound on an altar and not a sound. Not a tear coming from his eyes. As a matter of fact, there's a midrash that says that the angels, seeing that Yitzchak is about to be slaughtered, and Abraham is holding on with all of his strength, closing himself up, that they cry. And it is the tears from the angels that fall into the eyes of Isaac that ultimately give him poor eyesight so that later on in life, he cannot tell the difference between his son Yaakov and his son Esau when he gives a blessing. Because Abraham couldn't cry. Angels had to cry for him. And then comes the Haftarah. And it tells us of Chana crying. Chana, the wife of Elkanah, not the only wife, was a polygamy society. His other wife, Peninnah, has children and constantly taunts her. Ah, you can't get pregnant. You can't give our husband a child. You can't give him a son. Only I can. And the Torah tells us, Vayivkan, she cried. Her husband Elkanah says to her, stop crying. There's nothing we can do about it. I love you. Am I not as good as 10 sons? But it's not enough. Chana continues to cry. As I said earlier, the pain of a woman who wants a child and not being able to conceive is a pain that too many women in this world know, but the rest of us can't feel. Chana felt it, and she cried. The Haftarah tells us that when Eli, the priest, saw her crying in the temple in Shiloh, he couldn't understand what was going on. How could a woman lose herself in this holy and sacred shrine? So he condemns her and he says, you must be drunk. Lady, before you come into the shul, no more alcohol, no more drinking. You're a drunkard. You don't belong here with your expression of emotion that way. And Chana responds, Laduni, it is not so, my lord. Yain v'shech haloshatiti, I did not drink any wine or abuse any alcohol. Isha kishot ruach anochi. I am a woman in broken of spirit. I am pouring out my heart to God. I am pouring out my heart to God. I am opening myself up. I'm letting out my emotions. I don't care what the rules and restrictions in this place are. I'm a person. I'm real. And I'm going to be real right here because here I'm reading not you. Here I'm facing God. And when Eli realizes his mistake of having judged her so quickly, Vayan Eli, he responds to her saying, Lechida Shalom, you are right. You can go home in peace. Elohei Yisrael Yitena Shalech. Because you have opened up your heart, the God of Israel will grant your request. And indeed, Hannah returns home. By the next year, she's pregnant and gives birth to a son. Many of us have been taught, like the words of Eli, like the words of Elkanah, Al Tivki, don't cry. Boys Don't Cry is not just the title of a film. It's the way that boys and girls too, in many cases, have been raised. That crying is a sign of weakness. That one's releasing their emotions from deep inside is wearing your heart on the sleeve with a negative connotation. It doesn't belong in public. I think back with all the memories I can evoke in trying to recall my parents crying. And I can't remember. My father left his family at the age of 17 from a shtetl in Lithuania, never to see them again. What did he feel inside? Coming to a strange land with a language he didn't know. He couldn't even get off the boat because of the quota. He ended up in Cuba. He worked as a carpenter to a man who couldn't believe he was a Jew because he didn't have horns. I met a man, by the way, I want to tell you, I met a man, my father died, unfortunately, at the age of 58, many, many years ago. But it wasn't so long ago in Los Angeles that I met a man who told me, Rabbi Levin, he said to me, I think I remember your father. He had also left Lithuania, had also been in Cuba, and he lived a long life. And he told me the stories of the boys who would buy goods, shirts, pots and pans, and they would go out to the Konuku, to the outlying areas in Cuba to sell their wares, and many of them didn't come back, not because they met a girl, but because they were killed for the little money that they had collected. Came back, made it to the United States 5 years later, married, started a family, I was born, and then what? He gets the news that every member of his family left in Europe perished in the Holocaust. I asked my mother, Mom, what did Daddy say when he learned it? She says, I don't know. Did he cry? Was he in anguish? Did he go away? Did he seclude himself? I don't remember it. A man getting the news that his father was already gone, but that his mother and every one of his brothers and sisters and sisters-in-law, brothers-in-law, and all their children, his nieces and nephews that he knew, they were all shot to death. The remaining ones went to the gas chambers. What did he feel inside? I don't know. And then after my second brother was born, they had a little girl. She was 2.5 months old. My mother went out one day to the port to see how she was doing, and she was blue, gone. Sudden infant death syndrome. They didn't know the term then. And my mother herself, she lost a daughter. Where were her tears? Why can't I remember them? Why weren't they expressed? When my father died, she was a young woman. She was widowed and had 3 sons. Where were the tears? Where's the cry? They were there, yes. But they were held back. They were taught, don't wear your heart on your sleeve. Keep it inside. Don't let it out. I know the emotions were there. You see, on the eve of Rosh Hashanah, on the eve of Yom Kippur, my father would give me a blessing that was different from the bracha he gave me every Friday night. And Friday night, there was the classic priestly blessing with Ephraim and Menashe, a blessing of prosperity. But on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, he added the blessing of the hope of long life for his children. And I saw his eyes well up with tears, and his voice became choked as he put his hands on my head and pressed me close to him. But I didn't hear him cry. And I wish I did. I don't think I'm alone. I think that Ner Tamid in particular has a lot of people who were somehow given the same message as I was. That we don't cry. We don't open our hearts. We don't reach into our emotions and allow ourselves to feel, certainly not in front of anyone else, and after a while, not even in front of ourselves. I have seen tears in some people's eyes. I have. When there have been losses, deaths, yard sites, remembrance, I have seen some people cry. But the tears are stifled. There's an attempt to hold them back. We're embarrassed by really showing our emotions. And we have emotions. We have pain. We have suffering. For each and every one of us, there have been times in which our hearts have been broken. We have longings. We have regrets. There are people whom we loved and now we miss. Even if we're not separated from them by death, we're separated from them by distance. And yet we hold back feeling. We hold back an expression of our emotion. We hold back the tears that Hagar and that Chana and that the angels above released. I think that the first day of Rosh Hashanah, with the sounding of the shofar and this machloket, this disagreement between the sages, claiming that the purpose of the shofar is not to call us to arms or announce a new year, but rather to get us to reach inside and to feel the sigh, to hear the tears, to express the crying. I think that that is a lesson of Rosh Hashanah on the first day. And that's why it's repeated three times, and that's why it's in three different sections. First, it's combined, Shvarim Teruah, the three blasts that are broken sounds. It's the Teruah, it's the long blast, broken into three. And then comes the wailing. Ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. At first, they're connected. And then the sages said, now, let's separate them so that each has its full expression. So that the brokenness we feel inside can be felt, and then the tears, the crying that we have inside, can emanate. And we do it each one, not once, but three times, to make sure we've done it. Because the first time, you might miss it. Even the second. Three times. And it comes through. That's why we wash our hands three times from washing. Make sure you've done it. These women of today's Torah and Haftarah reading, they're teaching us what to do with Rosh Hashanah. They're teaching us not only for this day, but for the whole year, of the need to open our hearts, to share our emotions with each other and with ourselves. Because, my friends, our emotions are what we really are. We are not our height. We are not our weight. We're not the color of our hair. We're not the accents with which we speak. Those are all trappings. The real you is what you feel. The real you is what you feel. If you feel love, that's you. If you feel sadness, that's you. If you feel laughter and joy, that's you. If you feel pain and wailing, that's you. We are our emotions. Anybody who's been to any therapy knows that. That's the therapist's job, to get you to feel what you feel. Not what he or she feels or what you're supposed to feel or what your parents told you to feel, but what you feel. That's who we are. And if on Rosh Hashanah we're supposed to learn to be real, if we're supposed to take the sounds of the shofar and let them have an impact on us, that's what we have to do, feel. And so if you sit here for the next 2 days and then Yom Kippur, and you sit here and just go through the prayers without letting them touch you in your heart, you're missing it. If you listen to the sound of the shofar, you say, wow, he's a good shofar blower. I wonder if you'll suppose a trumpet. You're missing it. It's to evoke our feelings. That's what it's for. It's to open up our hearts so that we can be real. And maybe even have the courage to be real in front of each other. So my friends, this is my wish and my prayer for you on this Rosh Hashanah. I pray that you cry. I pray that you release the pain that's inside, the regrets, the longings, the hurts, the abandonment. And then I believe that we will find what Chana found when Eli said to her, "Lechi l'shalom, now that you've poured your heart out, now you will go in peace." Elohei Yisrael itein shiratcha. Because when you open yourselves up and you're real, then God will answer your prayers. I bless you with a good, tearful New Year. Amen.